All good stories contain a surprise, often the discovery that a key character is much different than we first assumed. Spies, wizards, long-lost relatives, the little guy with unexpected courage, the beautiful swan in the guise of an ugly duckling. In J.R.R. Tolkien's masterwork, Lord of the Rings, the hobbits who stopped in Bree when they first left the Shire encountered a solitary figure who was dressed for life in wild country, a ranger known as Strider. He turned out to be Aragorn, heir of Isildur, the king of Gondor. And his coronation is the climax to which all of the adventures of hobbits, wizards, elves, and men were headed in Tolkien's story. Doesn't appear at first to be a king. He turns out to be the king whose coming to the throne was the point and the climax of the book. There is a story as well in the Song of Solomon, which we're studying together. It's more difficult to follow. It's a story presented to us in a series of slides or snapshots, poetic snapshots, if you will, and they aren't necessarily in chronological order. We have to work a little bit to piece together the story, but there is one there. And it is also the story of unexpected royalty coming into the light. We're going to begin reading today in verse 6 of chapter 3. And we're going to encounter one of the difficult passages. I've been saying this every week. Well, this is a difficult passage, it seems like. But once again, this is a really difficult passage. Partly because as you'll see in a moment, it's so out of place. We have just been looking at a couple, a man and a woman, falling in love in sort of rustic country surroundings. And now all of a sudden there's this march of Solomon and his royal retinue and so on. It just seems to jump from nowhere into the middle of the text. And what is it doing here? And there's an interpretive question I want to ask having read it, but let me begin reading first in verse 6. Of chapter 3. Who is this coming up from the desert like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant? Look, it is Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with a sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon. Its posts he made of silver, its base of gold, its seat was upholstered with purple, its interior lovingly inlaid by the daughters of Jerusalem. Come out, you daughters of Zion, and look at King Solomon, wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. Well, one of the questions that gets asked about this book is how many men are in the story? There's only one woman, clearly, one bride, and there is this chorus that will show up and will play an important role again today. But the question is, how many men are there? And there's either two or one. And if there are two, then one of them is the rustic shepherd boy who is the true love of the bride and their story is being told. And the other is this sort of powerful rich guy shows up here, and he comes onto the stage to sort of win the girl away from her true love. And he's a bad guy and needs to be resisted. That's one reading of the story. I think that is the least likely scenario that makes sense of everything we have here. Another way of reading the story is to say that there's only one guy, but that he is Solomon. And he is a king's son, marries young, destined for royalty, lives in palaces, marches in parades, has soldiers, all of that sort of thing. And all of the rustic stories, when we see them off in the country or in villages and so on, and the language like Solomon or the lover, the man, pastures his flock in such and such a place, that's really all metaphor. All of the rustic language is metaphor. And so Solomon pasturing his flock is really the king taking care of his country or something like that. And so the metaphors are the country scenes. The third way to read it, which is the way I think makes most sense that I'm persuaded of, is that it's the story really of ordinary people. And all of the scenes in which there's this royal regalia, in which there's this excess of gold and silver and pomp and circumstance and so on, that those are the metaphorical scenes. That those are the scenes in which love, the eyes of love, sees in an ordinary person a regal countenance. And one of the reasons I'm persuaded of this is I think it's consistent with the gospel. That God sees in ordinary people more than we can see in ourselves. That it is His love that transforms us. That there's power and honor and integrity and beauty about us that we haven't discovered yet. And the one who loves it sees it in us, and we become what our lover sees. I believe this is a story of a pair in humble circumstances, and love transforms the ordinary into the extraordinary. And as I said, it is the message of the gospel. United with Christ, we become royal sons and daughters. The obscure are rendered beautiful. The isolated are embraced. So what is the scene? There may have been a parade like this that occurred somewhere in somebody's experience. It's possible that the bride and maybe everybody in the village saw such a group go by at some point or other, Solomon on his carriage, the king, and so on. But it gets applied in a particular way here that's interesting. Verse 11 is the most important or the most helpful, I think, of the verses I just read in 6 through 11. Because it's in some ways, it steps back from the gaudy and the remarkable. And it says this, verse 11. Come out, daughters of Zion, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him. Now, the most royal thing you could wear is something given to you by your father, who is the king, and so on. But that isn't the case here. This is an emblem that this man's mother gave him for his wedding day, the day his heart rejoiced. And so I think what we're supposed to be seeing is that this is the wedding day. This is the wedding day of the bride and groom. And the bride sees her husband coming towards her, perhaps down the streets of the village. Or we don't know the customs of the day. In most weddings in this place and in our setting, the groom is waiting and the bride comes to him from a distance. Apparently, by whatever means, the bride is looking and sees the husband coming, and she draws the story from the parade that she saw of Solomon at one point, or using her imagination. And she calls her husband Solomon. And she loves him in a way that makes him transformed from an ordinary shepherd into a figure of grandeur in her eyes. Probably he is actually riding in a farmer's cart, if he's riding in anything, but she sees it as the carriage of Solomon, inlaid with gold, covered with purple. Probably he has with him his brothers and a cousin and a couple of guys from the neighborhood, and they're kind of bounding along with him to the wedding, but she sees 60 soldiers strapped with swords and, you know, gallant warriors, she's not seeing this falsely. She's seeing something that the eyes of love see, that this man whom she's giving her life to is worth more than anybody can guess, is greater than anyone can know. Love's like that. It changes us. Being loved changes us. There was a similar scene, you remember, in chapter 1, where the woman cried out and said, don't look at me. I don't like who I am. I don't like how I look. I've been mistreated by my brothers. My life is hard. My appearance is unattractive. And then we hear the voice of her lover saying, no, you're completely beautiful to me. And she is stabilized by hearing his voice speak love to her. Now she's returning the favor and speaking this way of her man. And it's a wedding day. And it's a beautiful day. And chapter 4 begins the wedding night, the honeymoon, the scene to get them, with them together in their bedroom as husband and wife for the first time. But I want to take a break, a little hiatus before we look at the wedding night. And I just want to sort of give a word about weddings. And this is completely off topic in general. It's not in the Song of Solomon. It's a little commercial. We'll get back to it. But the word about weddings is this. I've tried to count them up. I'm sure I've done at least 200 weddings here, participated in at least 200 weddings. It may be closer to 250. And I was with some friends the other night. They were one of the first young couples I married, about our age, about less, same age Leslie and I had dinner with them the other night. I'm met this week with a young couple who are about to get married this summer, so it's sort of all, kind of the range, 36-year range, all these weddings. And I've been reflecting on kind of what's changed over time or what is true, what should be true. And what I realized is that I have as a firm conviction now that weddings are supposed to be joyful. I think it was Jesus' attitude towards weddings. It is precisely why he refused to let the wine run out in the case of his friends in the wedding in Cana. Weddings are supposed to be filled with joy, delight, the love of a couple overflowing to the love of everyone else for them, the blessing of God, a sense that this is a great place to be for all of us. A good thing is being accomplished, and it is good for everybody, couple, attendants, guests, and everybody. But weddings aren't always joyful, or they don't always major in joyfulness in any case. And when I look back, I think it would have been fair to say that when we were younger, when Leslie and I got married, and kind of our friends and contemporaries, and sort of the way of thinking about weddings that obtained in those days, is that exuberance was a little bit suspect. You didn't want to sort of overdo it. Weddings should be spiritual. And so weddings, therefore, of that sort should, you know, major in long sermons. little worried about funny stories and tears and toasts and hopes for a good future. There should be sort of a wet blanketism that enters in here, because they're supposed to be spiritual, and you don't want to let exuberance, you know, have its head, or who knows what will happen. And I think, you know, to the extent that caricature was true, I think it was wrong. Weddings are supposed to be joyful. But there's a problem, I think, on the other end of the scale, if you will, that seems much more likely the case today. And that is the need for high production values in this thing has grown so immense. The attention to detail, the stress, the size, the overwhelming nature of what needs to happen to get anybody married anymore has made it impossible for joy to sort of find its way into the room. Stressing about the color of the napkins for the 13th course of a 15th course meal, and having that rob you of any sense that a good thing's happening here is crazy. And I think the sense that massive amounts of money, massive amounts of stress, impossible standards need to be met has sort of become more and more true, even in among church folk, let alone everybody else. And to the extent that it's true, weddings, I think, have lost the joyful heart that should be there. I've been in some weddings recently where the videographer is more noticeable than the bride. Something wrong with that. Who cares what the videographer looks like? So it's an advertisement for joy in weddings. I think it was Jesus' attitude towards weddings. And, you know, may God make it ours. But to return to the text, chapter 4, as we said, verse 11 of chapter 3 makes the point that it is the wedding day, and the bride sees her husband. We only get her words on that occasion. She sees a king come, arrived for her. And then we turn to verse 1 of chapter 4. The groom speaks, "How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves." Now, I think what's happening here is that he is undressing her. And he says first that the veil covers her face. "Your eyes behind your veil are doves." And then pick up the reading again. Then he talks about her hair and then her face and so on. So apparently he's removed the veil, eyes behind the veil. Then he speaks of her hair unveiled in her face and her neck and her breasts. And it's as if he's undressing her, I think. but listen and see what you think. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn coming up from the washing. Each has its twin. Not one of them is alone. Your lips are like a scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David built with elegance. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies until the day breaks and the shadows flee. I will go to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of incense. All beautiful you are, my darling, there is no flaw in you. Now, clearly there is strong emotion here. There is physical touching here. There is exalted language here. And they all go together. The touching of one's beloved, the gentle caress, looking in her eyes, speaking of her beauty, being moved by love for her, it sort of all creates intimacy clearly. It is something very beautiful. Now, animals, of course, communicate nonverbally, and they manage to reproduce. But what sets human beings apart is that intimacy of this sort is not just about reproduction. It's about connecting two people. It's about meaning, that there is a nearness of two souls, two people who are making a life together, creating understanding, not just experience. And, of course, the scriptures say that human beings are made in the image of God. And I think the things that make the image of God visible or apparent or real in us are the very things that allow us to have a relationship that's more than just a physical relationship. What you mean to me. The ability to speak. We are not just bodies that host genetic code to be passed on to the next generation. But we have the capability of speech, of oneness, of meaning, of connection to whole human beings with each other. And that's what's taking place here, I think. Verse 8. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of... This is the groom still speaking. From the crest of Amana to the top of Senir, the summit of Hermon, from the lion's dens and the mountain haunts of the leopards. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine and the fragrance of your perfume than any spice. Your lips drip sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like that of Lebanon. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. There are two ideas here, I think, that in addition to the continued speech and the continued praise and love and connection of that the speech allows, there's two ideas here that are important. One is that this bride has a history. It is not just her physical beauty that's being described, as if it could be put on like makeup, and that any beautiful face is like any other beautiful face, and I can speak of, you know, the pomegranates which are your cheeks, and they could be like anybody else's, and so on. It's not generic beauty that he's seeing. It's personal. He knows her story. He's inviting her to come from Lebanon, where she was raised, with her history of walking its hills and drinking from its streams, and a life that formed her in the place where she lived and grew. And he knows her. He's speaking of a person, not just a form that is beautiful, but a person that is beautiful. And he's inviting her to join him. Come from Lebanon. Join me in my life. It's a bit like Genesis. You leave father and mother and cleave to your spouse and make a life together. Come with me on our wedding night. Come join me. He's inviting. The other thing that's significant here, I think, is the reference to a garden that is enclosed, a garden that's locked. And he's begun this disrobing of her, and he's praising her beauty, but he stops, speaks further, and then finally stops altogether. And he's waiting for her to respond, for her invitation that they make love, for her agreement, for her acceptance, for her embrace. It's not something that happens kind of with his interests alone, but he waits, and on your time, your choice, yourself, he's invited her and he's waiting. And then verse 16, the bride speaks now. "Awake, north wind, and come, south wind, blow on my garden that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits." Then the groom speaks. "I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey, and I have drunk my wine with my milk." And then remarkably, the chorus speaks, the last phrase of verse 1 of chapter 5. "Eat, O friends, and drink your fill, O lovers." When the bride speaks, she extends her arms to him, invites him to her, and there's a graceful and mutual consummation of their love on their wedding night, clearly what happens. But the chorus is striking. What is it doing here? Now, I've said before that the chorus shows up all throughout this book, sometimes specifically called the Daughters of Jerusalem, sometimes not called anything. And the chorus functions in different ways. Sometimes the chorus is real people being addressed. That's what we said last week, that the Daughters of Jerusalem were some real people who were, and there's a real conversation and real instruction taking place. Sometimes the chorus, even when they're called the Daughters of Jerusalem, I think function more as a diary, especially for the bride, in which she's thinking thoughts and wants to understand herself and is asking herself questions and sort of writing in her own diary to herself observations, questions, wonderings, and so on. There's no other person really there. She's speaking to herself. I think another thing that happens with the chorus is that it sometimes is the voice of the author. And indeed, it is the voice of the heavenly author. It is God's voice. And I think that is clearly the case here. "Eat, O friends, and drink your fill, O lovers." This is God's blessing on the life as husband and wife that they have begun together in this time and place. And it says something, assuming this is true, it says something about God, doesn't it? He not only gives us gifts sort of extended from his hand, but he blesses us in the receiving of the gifts. He gave us speech as a gift. He gave us bodies as a gift. He gives us friendships is a gift. He gives us marriage as a gift in some cases. He gives us all of the possibilities of that make life really worth living. And then he stays himself in the midst of them and speaks blessing on our enjoyment of his gifts. The gifts don't proceed from his hand and he vanishes. He stays present and blesses us in the enjoyment of them. It's a powerful picture of how good God wants to be to us, both in what he gives and in his word of approval regarding what he gives to us. Well, the door closes on the bedroom, and we step away. What we've been doing there, it's a little hard to know. Why have we been invited into the, you know, as readers into this scene? But nonetheless, well, it's over. We step away, and I just want to sort of ask a couple questions and make a couple of observations. One question is essentially this. When you think of your life and your relationships and the people you care about, what is the first thing? Is the first thing the experience of accomplishing something, or is the first thing the experience of being loved? And I think for most of the significant accomplishments that anyone gains in life, the first thing is that we are loved enough to attempt something, to believe something, to choose something. It starts. The first thing is that we're approved of. The first thing is that we are desired. The first thing that is that we are chosen. The first thing is that we're loved. And being loved, we make our way in the world and accomplish whatever it is we'll accomplish. And the reason I ask that question is I think an awful lot of folks are setting aside the possibility of a relationship, a marriage, a lasting love relationship, until they accomplish something important first. Well, I got to get my degree first, and I got to get a job, and I got to get out of debt, and I got to achieve these things, and I want to get to a certain status, and I want to please a bunch of people that are looking on. And once I've achieved all these things, then I'll be ready to be open to a relationship that has love in it. And, of course, I want the person I love to have accomplished all these things as well, because to be worthy of me, they would need to have, you know, be roughly equal. And so all this time goes by with attempting to become something and postponing the possibility of making a life with someone. And in general, God's call to every life is different. And that's the most important question you can ask is, what is God's choice for me? But if you want a general thought, I think to begin taking on life with someone whom you love and will love you will allow you to become and grow and change and achieve the things you want in a healthier way rather than sort of waiting to become the person in order to add someone to your life. Beginning together, learning together, stumbling together, getting back up again, becoming what you want to be with someone who cares for you is in most respects, I think, wiser than attempting to make yourself and then add someone to it. The other question I think that comes from this for me is, what happens when honeymoons end? Because they always end. The wedding night, this is an exquisite wedding night. This guy had all the right lines. I've never met, you know. I mean, just perfect timing, kind of the gentle touch, the removal of the veil, the choice words, just waiting, hoping, you know, moving forward, moving back, timing, you know, the whole thing. In fact, I was even laughing at one point. You almost wonder if the woman wasn't saying at some point, you know, shut up and kiss me, you know, enough with the pomegranates and the, you know. But anyway, there's this sort of kind of remarkable, you know, it's a beautiful wedding night, and it's supposed to be a beautiful wedding night. And you know, and her response and their experience and the blessing of God. But it ended for them. In fact, what we're going to see next week is an argument between the two of them, just to sort of put ourselves on notice. It ends for everybody. The honeymoon ends. And for some, there is no honeymoons. For some, the hope to have a relationship never quite materializes, or the relationship is a struggle from day one, or you know, the honeymoon itself was never that terrific. You know, we were so exhausted while we have, you know, the honeymoon itself does not have glorious memories. Or, so, you know, it's one thing to sort of see a beautiful picture painted, but what about real life when conversations later end up being more about, you know, who's going to feed the cat and change the diapers and pay the bills and take care of the stuff and much more frequently. Vastly much more frequently are those conversations than any conversation like this. I think the point of the poem, I think the point of God sort of saving people out of a broken world is to give us good experiences and his gifts and his blessing. I mean, his gifts and his presence, that's an important part of this. He gives us good gifts and he wants us to enjoy them. But inevitably, there will come a time when they're not enough, when they disappoint, when something happens, when age intervenes. Anyway, or whatever it is that intervenes. And you end up saying at the end, you know, this life really isn't all there is. That I will never be made as happy as I long to be in this life. There is no person here. I cannot be the person. I cannot find the person. I can't gain the experience. I can't hold on to the good thing that seems so remarkable and then you know, seems to lose, you know, or fades or is intruded upon. And that in the long run, we are being made to long for the world that is our home. And God gives us good gifts to make us thirsty for the real thing. And he sometimes withholds them so that we know, we'll know for sure that this life isn't going to pay off because we're made for another place. We're headed to a wedding day like no other. We're heading into a place of intimacy with Christ and with one another that we couldn't imagine and couldn't describe if we could imagine it. And God is good in order to be so that God can be better in some ways to us. We're going to take communion together now. Come forward to the communion table. And I want to remind us of Jesus' words in Matthew. He said, "I will not drink this cup again until I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." That one of the words of instruction regarding communion was that this is not the end. This is looking to the day when we will all drink this cup, eat this meal together again. This is a reminder of the past, of the cross for sure, but it's a down payment on the future as well, the day that's coming, the most beautiful thing. When we have this great supper together with him in the kingdom that hasn't arrived yet. So I want to ask you to pray with that in mind. As you come forward, the musicians will play quietly for a time. We'll sing a bit. And during that time, you'll have the space to come forward or to the corners in the back to partake of the Lord's Supper. Let me also just note that in front of me are a few cups. If there's a person near you that can't walk or needs your help, you could take the elements back to them as well. But join me in a word of prayer, if you would. Lord, thank you for your presence. Thank you for your gifts and your blessing to go along with your gifts. Thank you that there are sometimes such beautiful things that we wish they could last forever and find that they can't. And yet we long for great things that will never fade. In Jesus' name, amen.